Chapter 58. Ephraim, half-breed and hatchet face. I rush to the children's cage. A curtain of humid, urine-filled air hits me as I enter the unventilated room. Throwing the Duke down on the ground, I look through the cage to the boy and girl. The singing of my eardrums is fading. Hello, little humans. You might remember me. The girl spits at me. Syndicate scum! That's no way to welcome your saviour. Your mommy sent me to get you out.
My mother, the boy says.
Did I stutter? I realise then that I'm slurring my words. I spit out the rag. Bits of skin from the wound cling to it.
If mother sent you, where are the Lion Guards? The boy asks. The Telemanuses?
In the citadel, shining their armour and jacking it. How should I know?
Are you a lurcher?
Hell no. I bend to unclip the lock and then twist it so that the teeth of the lock disengage. I'm about to open it when I catch the girl's eyes again. I'm on your side, girlie. Few little brats want to see your parents again. You do just as I say. Otherwise, we'll all get peeled apart like onions for a stew. I watch them expectantly. This is the part where you nod. They both nod. First the boy, then the girl. Good. I open the latch and step back, keeping my gun trained on the Duke. The girl bursts out, but the boy follows more tentatively, eyeing the Duke and me curiously. He's more tender and scientific than the girl, it seems. More willing to cooperate. I'll talk to him. Then I feel something cold and metal against the back of my spine. I turn slightly and see the girl holding a solid razor to my back, which she must have fetched from the stack. I laugh at the size of it in her hands, but there's no humour in the pale girl's eyes. I'd call her bluff if I didn't know who her psychotic parents were. The kid is feral. Very smart, little lady. Kill your ticket out of here. I step away from the razor. She shuffles forward, the blade never leaving my spine. I look to the boy. Will you tell her to stop slagging about? We're wasting time.
Electra, he's right.
The girl twitches her blade to the side and cuts me shallowly on the arm.
Damn it! I'm bleeding enough, I say.
That's a down payment, she replies.
She reaches into the box of razors, trying them till she finds another blade. She tosses it to the boy. He catches it nimbly and spins it in his small hands. Little warlords, I remind myself.
What's our point of egress?
The boy asks me, like he's a real soldier. There's a ship on a private dock 2 floors up, I say, holding up the key. There's also a main garage, but it'll be swarming with thorns.
Place will already be swarming, the Duke says bitterly. Your dead flesh walking.
He's right, the girl mutters. You made hell coming in here.
Sound might not have travelled, I say hopefully.
We heard it through the vault, Grey.
What's your name? The boy asks me.
My name? I laugh.
Ephraim. He extends a small hand. The little half-breed is mocking me, but his eyes are sincere. I laugh again and take the small hand. There are no sigils on it, but I'm surprised by the calluses I find there.
Pax, he says. Are the Telemanuses alive? The rest of the staff?
Don't know. I grab the Duke and haul him to his feet. Up, Highness. You're our human shield. I straighten his jacket and leave him between the little monsters with their razors at the mouth of the vault. The Duke cowers. He's already attacked me twice. I was surprised. I thought he'd wilt like a flower as soon as I threatened him. Watch him for a moment. Stick him if he gets out of line.
Immobilizing strike or just a flesh wound? The girl asks.
Gory hell, just watch him, little psycho. The boy grows quiet and serious. as he sees the bodies outside the vault. Unfazed, the girl turns back impatiently as I cram the bag I brought full of gems and bearer bonds. It breaks my heart to see how little I can fit in the bag and how much loot I'll leave behind. I could spend days in here. Place would have melted Sierra's circuits.
"What are you doing?"
the girl says, scowling. "Sorry, I have a problem." I zip shut the bag and throw it up on my shoulder. I contemplate taking a razor for a souvenir, but the things are damn terrifying, so I settle for an old iron ring with a three-headed dragon snarling out from its surface. I'm about to leave when I catch sight of a familiar splash of blue and yellow paint on a canvas out of the corner of my eye. It can't be.
Gray, we have to go.
I ignore her and rifle through the stacked canvases, tossing several million credits worth of paintings on the ground, and pull out a small framed oil-on-canvas painting. I laugh incredulously at the picture of Dali's dread monster. In bright, cracked colours, soft watches drape over a tree branch and against the corner of a brown shelf. It is La Persistencia de la Memoria. I'm suddenly conscious of the blood on my fingers.
Gray!
The girl shouts. Wiping my hands, I carefully cut open the back of the frame and slide the canvas out, rolling it gently and slipping it into the bag. Feeling a bit lighter, I join the children. I once investigated this claim. They said it was lost in a fire, I say with a laugh. I knew they were lying.
Stealing even now? The girl sneers. You're disgusting.
Quiet, hatchet face. I grab the Duke by the back of his collar and push him through the entry room to all the double doors. Everyone stick close to me. If anyone comes close, you stab them right in the jewels. Understand? They both nod. The boy is a model of concentration. He paled when he saw the bodies I left on the floor, but now he's lowered his head in anger. Same dead-set jaw as his father, but his hands shake as they hold the too large razor. Pretend to be spawn of the Reaper all he likes. He's just a terrified boy.
You ready, little monsters?
They nod. I look at the closed door leading out of the antechamber back into the hall and feel the dread of what lies beyond it seep into me. Let's go. We open the door. Half a dozen guns roar. The door shakes and wood shatters as bullets and energy chew into it. I slam close the door and duck with the children, hauling the Duke down into my lap.
You blind idiot, I shout over the Duke's head. I have your Duke.
No one responds from the other side.
You, peek out there, I tell the girl.
Her eyes widen.
What? You're the most expendable. Look out there and tell me what you see. Slag you.
Fine. I grab the Duke and shove him out, then jerk him back.
What do you see?
Fuck you.
Will no one cooperate?
I'll do it, Pack says. Before he can move, the girl shoves him back and darts her head to look through the holes in the door, then dips back to shelter.
Four obsidian braves, 6 Greys, 3 Browns, 6 EFC-37 rifles, 2 GR-19 pistols, 2 Eagle 4 PR-117s, a Vulcan 8K pulse fist. Couldn't make out the rest.
I stare at her. So, no dolls for you, huh?
What's this your plan?
She asks.
How is this your plan?
Yap, yap, yap. You're the one who got kidnapped, dumbass. I rise to a crouch and push my gun against the Duke.
Tell them not to shoot.
Don't shoot.
Louder, obviously.
He glares at me like he has a choice. I grab his balls through his robe and twist.
Don't shoot! This is your Duke! Don't shoot!
I dare a quick peek out through the door. A row of thorns clog the hallway. They look at each other in confusion. Tell them to put their weapons on the ground.
Put your weapons on the ground.
I look out again. Well, look at that, They're obeying.
"We're coming out," I say. I push the Duke up and rise myself, using him as a shield, keeping an arm around his throat and the gun to his head. We shuffle out the door. I have to kick it open. Their fusillade knocked it half off its hinges. The children follow. "Well, this is a bit awkward," I say, facing the line of cutthroats. Some are in their dusters, others look just roused from bed by the commotion. Their guns litter the floor. "I need you to back away, down the hall. Then put your sacks and clams to the floor. If anyone rises or looks at me in a way that displeases me, I'll relieve the Duke of his head. Crystal?" The men look to the Duke.
"Do it,"
he hisses.
"Obey him."
The thorns back away from their weapons and lie on the floor. There's four obsidians amongst them. Those I watch most carefully. Gorgo isn't there. Not good. We move quickly through the seeded floor. Pax grabs a small plasma pistol from the ground. The girl turns up her nose at this in favour of her razor. They follow tight behind me as I lead them to the lift bank. Electra hits the button with her razor's hilt. Pax's pistol suddenly goes off. The sound explodes in my ear. Plaster rains from the ceiling. "Half-breed, what the hell was that for?" I snarl. "One of them was reaching for something." "Well, then shoot him, not the ceiling." The lift dings behind me. We back into it. The Duke laughs a little mad laugh to himself, but says nothing of substance. The children are terrified, even the nasty girl. "Professional recommendation," I say, looking back at the boy. "Use that pistol on her, then yourself, if it looks like we're slagged." He looks down at the pistol. The girl glares at me. "Just trying to help." There's no one waiting for us on the Duke's level. Word must have travelled. But still, I expected Gorgo. We move quickly through the abandoned halls and make it back to the Duke's suite. Our dinner still sits on the table. Electra grabs a handful of octopus tentacle and jams it into her mouth as we pass. We access the patio outside, crossing a small gravel park with swirling white angel trees to reach the Duke's sparkling CR-17 Hornet. There's no sign of any thorns. Something's off. I keep the Duke between me and the building. Then I have an epiphany. "They're in the ship," I say. "Don't." Pax activates the door controls and the door hisses upward, revealing a dark interior. No one comes from inside. I look back to the building, not seeing any pursuers. Then I catch the glint of metal. Three stories up through a plate glass window, I see Gorgo's pale face to the side of a long barrel. There's a small flash. The window shatters. In this moment, I suddenly realize why Gorgo smiled when I called him the Duke's man. Something that feels like a hot hammer hits me in the right side of my chest. Everything goes very quiet and focused. Confused, I rock back on my heels, barely moved, and sway with the Duke, like we're slow dancing. I take a step backward, trying to pull the Duke into the ship. My heel catches and I fall backward, with the Duke on top of me. I stare at the back of his head and part of the sky and breathe his hair. I try to push him off and get up, but he doesn't move. I try to crawl out from under him. The Duke is making a rattling sound with his mouth. I crawl free of him and twist myself to my belly to try to stand. I can't get up. My right arm is too weak to push. "Help," I say distantly, quietly, confused at why I can't rise. "Help." I'm not even sure who I'm talking to. I feel hands under my arms, the boys hauling at me to get me up. I almost tip over again. "Leave him," the girl cries. "Come on," the boy shouts in my ear. I push with my legs and use him to stumble toward the door, leaving the Duke behind to bleed out on the edge of the ramp. I feel better with each step. The girl stands there with her legs spread, both hands on the boy's stolen pistol, firing wildly up at the window.
The pains around Gorgo vaporize. Another shot from Gorgo slithers under my left ear, taking the bottom of the lobe. It slams into the metal of the ship and ricochets till it embeds itself in the floor. I duck away from the door. Now, inside the ship's main hall. Must fly away. We have to take off, I say. With the boy following, I stumble to the cockpit and then sit down in the captain's chair. I stare at the controls, acclimating. I push the key in and twist. Lights come on the console. Greetings, Your Ethereal Majesty, the vessel purrs. I press the engine ignition. The Hornet's twin ion engines thrum to life. Close the door, the girl is shouting. Close the gory damn door! I look for the ramp retraction button and can't find it, still dazed. The boy reaches past me from the co-pilot seat and presses it. I feel the ramp retract into the ship. He asks me something. I turn to look at him. Hmm? Can you fly? He asks me. Of course I can fly. I reach for the elevation thruster controls and activate them. The Hornet levitates up off the landing pad. I push forward on the main engine throttle and we rocket away from the landing pad out into Endymion's cityscape. Gory hell, the girl says. The tower shrinks behind us. That was manic. You prime, Electra? Pax asks. She nods. Is the Duke dead? I ask. Hell if I know, the girl replies. Where are you taking us? The boy asks. Back to the Hyperion. It'll take us an hour's flight time in this. I can get your mummy's men to rendezvous halfway. Syndicate will have this thing tracked, but short of military ships, nothing can catch a Hornet. Long as we don't set down, we're safe, and you're home to mummy. We should hail the local watchman, the boy says, and roll the dice that they're not on the Syndicate payroll. I thought your parents were geniuses. They are. I grunt. Mustn't be genetic. They're both staring at me funny. What? I ask. Got something on my face? Are you prime? The boy asks me. I'm shiny. Shiny? He asks. Dog tongue, the girl says. You don't look shiny. You look like you're going to die. A regular font of cheer you are. A localized burning pain on my right pectoral begins to grow and grow until it's a horrendous agony. My entire chest is starting to cramp. Something wet and hot trickles down my flank and soaks into my underwear. I look down and see a small hole in my suit. I stick a finger in and feel a sharp pain on the torn skin. It comes away covered with blood. Cool shock ignites in my cells from my nipples down through my legs and toes, like I've been dunked in ice water. Oh, I've been shot, I say. It must have gone through the Duke into me. It seems obvious now, but in the moment I couldn't figure what happened. Have you been shot before? Pax asks warily. Not exactly. Congratulations, you just saw me get my cherry popped, I say through chattering teeth. It hurts worse by the minute. I look down at the wound. I thought I'd go into shock sooner. Fighting alongside the Suns, I saw Golds bleed out from scrap metal to the thigh. Others I've seen take bullets or pulse blast to the face and keep ticking with half their jaws hanging off. A Red once kept fighting for an hour with his arm a shredded stump from a grenade. Died after, but still. Everyone is different. I'm a little proud of myself. But the pride is quickly eaten up by fear. The wound is bad and there's no exit hole on my back. My fingertips are going cold. My teeth rattle together and the pain becomes unimaginable. I look over at the children, who talk amongst themselves as we fly over the manufacturing districts of Endymion, areas hard hit by the Battle of Luna and not as well loved by Quicksilver, and wonder if they know how bad the wound is. I shift over to the ship's holopad, which rests to the right of the flight control console, and tap in Holiday's number from memory. She answers the call almost immediately. I face her, the sovereign, and several others. Ephraim, she says in relief. Did you? Right here, I say. I expand the camera view to include the entire cockpit so they can see the children too. Pax, the sovereign says, her voice almost breaking. Tears fill the girl's obnoxiously symmetrical eyes. I'm here, mother. Did they hurt you? No, he lies. I'm safe. The sovereign looks to someone off camera. Call Victra. Tell her Electra is alive. She'll hit the syndicate if she knows. I'm counting on it. The sovereign looks back to the camera. Where are you, Ephraim? Send us your coordinates and my men will rendezvous. No, I say. I'm not going to risk you shutting me in prison. Release Volga, and soon as she's safe and tidy, I'll dump the kids on a rooftop. Then your men can find them. That wasn't what we agreed upon. Tough, bloody luck. You're bleeding everywhere, Electra says. She looks past me. He's going to crash the ship anyway. I'll trust a back-alley yellow's clinic before I'll trust a gull's word, I sneer. We're going to the Citadel, Pax says from behind me. Maybe you didn't hear. I turn and find the tip of a razor centimetres from my right eyeball. He stands in a fencer's position. Comply, citizen, or I'll be forced to learn how to fly a ship.
Chapter 59 Lyria Forgiveness. From a balcony, I watch a squadron of ripwings rise from the Palatine landing pads up into the night. Their engines plume blue and shrink in the distance, leaving the citadel wall behind and crossing the trees toward Hyperion. The children are safe, and so is Ephraim. My own relief in knowing the bastard lives comes as a surprise to me. I've never been the forgiving type, but I feel pity for the man and his pain. I recognize the fear in him when he saw the obsidian the Sovereign's men captured. He's a man, like my father, like my brothers, raised in a place without love, trampled by the same clumsy republic that brought us from the mines. I can't hate him any more than I can hate myself. Maybe that isn't forgiveness, but it's all I have to give. Just because he has pain doesn't mean he should bring others into it. That's on him. Holiday stands motionless beside me, watching the ships, a wistful expression caged by the hard lines of her face. The Sovereign held her back from the mission, says it was because she hasn't slept in 48 hours, but even I know it's because of Holiday's connection to Ephraim. There's no forgiveness in the hard woman. I wonder if she was always this intense. What odds did you give him? I ask. At first I think she doesn't hear me and might be listening to the pilots and commandos on her internal comm. Then I realize she's just ignoring me. I don't gamble, she says after a moment. Course you don't. Ephraim won't die, she says. He blessed or something, touched by the veil. No, not blessed, she says distantly. He used to work for the Sons, you know, joined after my brother died. Her voice is slow and robotic. Served as a recruiter before becoming a scar hunter. Back before House Loon fell, before the Battle of Ilium even. When the Society's agents owned this moon, he brought in people like you, like me. He taught them how to fight, how to survive so they could take back just some of what'd been taken from them. After Luna fell to the Rising, he was given a mission in Endymion to find a gold who was organizing raids. It was a trap. They interrogated his men in front of him, skinned them alive, and made him watch. By the time we got there, he was the only one left. The gold was captured with the peeling knife in hand. She pauses, disliking the memory. But the gold had information the sovereign needed. Information he exchanged for a full pardon. Ephraim watched the man who skinned his friends walk free. She looks at me. Point is, Ephraim wants to die, but he can't. That's his curse. That's why you took the obsidian, I say. Because he couldn't watch another friend die? She shrugs. I know where to hurt. There's no regret in her eyes. She seems a person made all of flint and iron, one who came into the world full-born, without mother or father or past or future, less a woman than shovel or an axe. If there is more than that to her, she would never show it to me. What sort of person does that make you? I ask. She doesn't answer immediately. She points east to the new forum on the far side of the citadel grounds. The domed building is pale in the night and rises out of the trees around it like a hill of snow, stark in contrast with the brutal lines of the pyramid forum the society used. Beautiful, isn't it? I nod. She stares on at it. You think clean hands built it? The Sovereign is in conference with Theodora and Daxo when we join them. I keep my distance from both pink and gold, my arm still itching from the torture. Above the table, a map shows the progress of the squadron toward the stolen shuttle. The Sovereign watches it coolly as she converses with Theodora. But I can sense the underlying tension in her. Her eyes are bloodshot, and heavy bags have formed under them. Coffee cups and the remnants of a meal litter the table. How long can a gold go without sleep? Could not have done this alone, Daxo is saying to Theodora. He cuts short when he sees me enter the room with Holiday. Continue, the Sovereign says. Daxo hesitates for a moment with me in the room. The Syndicate is working with someone. I recommend we conceal this from the Senate until we know more. My spies will have names by the morning, heads by the end of the week. Theodora, the Sovereign asks. You know my thoughts, she says. The longer we hold this from the Senate, the more it discredits the transparency you promised them. Senator Caraval is already inquiring about the unusual traffic over Hyperion. It's stupid to go before them until my son is safe here by my side, the Sovereign says. I won't have those men saying a mother can't govern when her child is in danger. They'll smear me. And call a referendum to make me step down before the vote. With Caraval and the coppers lost, we're going to lose 6-7. My veto is all that can stop this absurd peace process. Who would replace you? Theodora asks. The Senate would vote. Majority rules until next election, Daxo answers. Until we know who did it, there will be suspicion that this is a ploy to delay the vote, Theodora says. I already know who did it, the Sovereign replies. Theodora and Daxo exchange confused glances. The Syndicate was hired, but by whom? Who has the most to gain? She waits for an answer. None comes. It was the Ash Lord. He can't beat our legions, so he's after our Senate. Darrow was right. This happened because I was weak, because I was tired. I never should have let the Vox chase him away. She focuses back on the hollow of her son's ship making its way back to Hyperion, her long fingers tapping her side. Lyria, she says, eyes boring into me. I don't bow my head this time, but stare back at her, knowing this is when the axe falls. Yet her tone surprises me. You made a dire mistake, girl. One that should end your service to me, to anyone. But without you, we would not have found this Volga and... She spares a glance to Holiday, Ephraim. Soon my boy will be back with me, because you were brave enough to own your mistakes. I must now own mine. How could she ever understand what her mistakes cost me? She's lost her son for a few days and she thinks she knows. She'll never know the mud, the flies. You lost your family, she says. You trusted the Republic, and we broke that trust. Then I'm struck dumb. She goes to a knee, her eyes on the ground. I do not deserve it, nor must you give it, but I ask all the same. Will you forgive us? Will you forgive me for not doing better? Forgive her? I don't understand the idea, nor do her counselors. They gawp down at her as off-footed as I am. Her golden braids are even with my eyes. There's loose strands, the faint earthy smell of oil and the coffee from her breath. I hear the air enter her mouth and fill her lungs and whistle out her nose, see her shoulders rise and fall. The power is shed, her naked soul there in front of me. She's just a woman. Just a mother with more children than any other. Maybe she does know my pain. Before this, she was a freedom fighter, a soldier. It's easy to forget that. She's seen mud, and now I think she remembers it. I can't hold on to the anger or the pettiness or the pain. I want only to help her, to protect families like mine. Letting go of that anger doesn't spit on the memories of Ava or Tiran or the children. It honours them. And for the first time I can remember, I feel hope. With a trembling hand, I reach and touch her head. She stands afterwards. Thank you. I nod, unable to put what's inside me into words that don't sound stupid. A storm is coming to the Republic, she says softly. This was just the first breath. You still have a part to play in all of this. What could I ever hope to do? I ask. You have a voice, don't you? When I go before the Senate, I will need you as a witness. Your testimony will save lives. It will bring the men behind this to justice. Will you help me, Lyria of Lagalos? If you promise me that Liam will be looked after and his eyesight given to him, I know there's a way, but I don't have the money. She looks down in amusement. Are you negotiating with me? I won't help you if you don't help him. Very well. It's agreed. I spit in my hand and stick it out to her. She looks down at it in surprise, then shakes my hand. I'm guided by Holiday to the door. There I turn back around. I wonder, could I see Kavix? No, the Sovereign says. I don't think that would be a very good idea right now. I nod and follow Holiday out of the room. At the doorway to my room, I stop. Could you tell Liam I'm all right? I ask her. He must have been worried. He was told you were on an errand for Kavix, she says. He wasn't worried. All the same, could I see him? I won't say a thing to him. I'm sorry. It was risk enough bringing you to speak with Ephraim. We can't have any more security risks. She watches my face fall without sympathy. Then a sigh escapes from her thin lips. What if I take candy or a little cake or something and say it's from you? Would that cheer you up? You'd do that? She shrugs. What's his favorite flavor? Chocolate. All right. I wait expectantly, looking up at her. What? You want a hug? Get inside. She shoves her fingers against the opening mechanism. The door slides into the wall. Oh, I say, and step in. Thank you for the... The door shuts in my face. Fucking greys, I mutter. The room is not grand, but it's clean and has a full water bathroom. Exhausted, I turn on the water to the shower till steam rises. I wriggle out of my borrowed clothes, awkward with the shoulder sling, and stand under the stream of hot water, thinking of how lucky I am to be alive, to not be on the run. You'd be proud of me, Ava. Ma, I know that. And there's more I can do. Help the Sovereign till this is through, and maybe we can bring all those bastards down. But it wasn't the Syndicate who killed my family. Whatever happens here, those Red Hand butchers will go unpunished. How can that be fair? How can it be right? I turn off the shower and stand near the exit fence so the hot air can evaporate the water from my stomach and breasts. When I open my eyes, I see a pair of white maid shoes on the wet white tile. My eyes track upward. The woman is a brown in her mid-30s with two great moles, a hooked nose, and a bird nest of hair. She holds a gun in her hand. At the end of it is a large hypodermic needle that she pulls out of my chest. I take a step toward her and lose my footing. I don't even feel the ground come up to greet me. The world fogs and spins. And the last I see is the woman patting my face. Hello, traitor. House Barker sends their regards.
Chapter 60. Darrow. Ashes to ashes. Apollonius, Severo and I cut our way through the fortress guards. It seems most of the manpower sent to fight beyond the walls, likely to stop Apollonius's forces from ever making landfall. Those who remain offer thin resistance to our combined violence. After shattering a trio of gold bodyguards near the gravlifts, we divide to search more efficiently for the Ash Lord. Severo and I stick together while Apollonius sets off on his own. The search does not take long.
This has to be it, Severo says outside a set of double doors gilded with gold.
They will be stained inside, I say. We should wait for Apollonius.
You need him to wipe your ass, too, Severo asks.
He kicks open the doors. Time for your bill, ass lord. The room is quiet. Despite the decadent floral mouldings and whitewashed walls, the room is cavernous and sparse, but for a large four-poster bed that looks out an open balcony window to the sea. A pulse shield ripples faintly outside the windowsill. Around the bed squat a legion of hulking polymelian forms. At first I think they are knights, but as a column of light from the outer suite illuminates the grey metal, I realize that they are not men at all, but medical machines. Small displays glow with life readings. An old pink in a nightgown and two brown servants holding fire pokers guard the foot of the bed, shielding its inhabitant from us. The browns charge, screaming at the top of their lungs. We take them down, trying not to kill them with our metal-covered fists. The pink at the bed is wailing.
No! She screams. Stay away from him!
I pull her from in front of the bed as Severo approaches it warily. She slashes at me with her nails, breaking them against my armor.
Monsters!
Her spit sprays my face.
You monsters!
Severo punches her in the back of the head. I catch her as she drops to the floor. A deathly stench fills the room. Severo stands at the base of the bed, his hand pulling back the silk curtains. His face is pale. Darrow. He jerks the silk curtains off the frame so I can see. On the bed, lying in a nest of blankets, are the remnants of a giant. When I met the Ash Lord as a lancer to Augustus, he stood over 7 feet in height and weighed as much as a Telemannus. At that time, he was edging past 100, but he was still stately and spry, despite his girth. That vigour he retained throughout our many bouts in the early stages of the war. And though his face has spoken on core broadcasts over the last years, I see now that it was a ruse, and why he hides here in his sea-swept citadel. Barely a third of the man remains. What does is emaciated and skeletal. His arms have shrunken in on themselves, the muscle withered away. The skin, once dark as onyx, is now loose and scabrous with yellow flakes, oozing pus into white bandages. His once bright eyes are sunken into his head, which is bald, the skin tight and dry like a thin layer of scale over his titanic skull. Wires and fluid lines connect to the machines that guard his bed, cycling his blood and removing his waste. It's as if he has been devoured from inside. I wondered who knocked, he murmurs. His eyes, stained with a rotten yellow infection, watch me without malice. A hologram floats beside his bedside, showing us the battle outside. I thought it was the Saud, finally come to reclaim their planet. But now I see it ends as it should, with wolves. The simple words brook no anger. The voice alone remembers the man. It is drum deep, defiant and proud, even trapped as it is in his wasted body, like summer thunder captured in a tattered paper lantern. For 10 years, we've been adversaries, have danced across the worlds in a never-ending duel, each move counted by the other, then recounted in one giant game on many boards. First, the metal jungle of Luna, the plains and seas of Earth and Mars, then the core orbits, till finally the sand belt of Mercury, where I took the planet and he broke my army. Now, all those vast theatres and the millions of men shrink down to this moment, to this small room on this far-flung isle. And none of it makes any bloody damn sense. Am I not as you expected? He asks with a smile. Let's just cut his head off, Severo says. Not yet. What are we waiting for? This piece of shit needs to meet the worms. Not yet, I snap. Severo paces around the bed in agitation. You are precisely what I expected, the Ash Lord says. The destroyer of a civilization too often resembles its founders. He wets his mouth from a water feeding tube and follows that up with a grotesque clearing of his throat. I must apologize, Darrow, for not seeing you sooner, when you were just a boy who broke his institute. Had I opened my eyes and noticed you, what a world we would still have. But I see you now. Yes, and you are immense. It's admiration in his voice. It's familiarity. How few people left breathing could understand this man. How many men know what it is like to give a command that kills millions? I swallow, my hatred for him quieted by the wretched thing he's become, and my fear at heading down the same broken road. This is not how I pictured our final confrontation. What happened to you? I ask. How long have you been like this? The Ash Lord ignores the question and searches my face.
I see you kept our scar and our eyes. Then what of the red remains?
Enough.
Ah, he says quietly. I suppose that is what every man must tell himself in war.
His voice rasps, and he sucks again on the water tube.
That there will be an end. And when it is done, enough of himself will remain. Enough to be a father, a brother, a lover. But we know it isn't true. Don't we, Darrow? War eats the victors last.
His words make a heaviness settle on me. I wish I could say I was different than him, that I will survive this war. But I know day by day the boy inside is dying. The spirit that ran through the halls of Lycos, that curled with Io in bed. He began to die the day he watched his father dangle from a noose and did not cry. It's a price I'm willing to pay to be done with you, I say.
That is part of your red genetic character, your yearning, your need to sacrifice. Brave pioneer, toil, dig, die for the good of humanity, to make Mars green. We designed you to be the perfect slave. And that's what you are, Darrow. A slave with many masters. Change your eyes, take our scar, break our reign. It won't change what you are at your core. A slave.
Bombs rumble outside. Severo spits at the corner, nearing the end of his patience. Lorne once said you were his greatest friend. I say, that you were once a man to be admired, before Rhea, before you crowned yourself with Ash.
Rhea was a rational transaction. 60 million lives to keep order for 18 billion.
His shrunken lips curl.
What do you think Lorne would have done if he saw what you were? Do you really think he would have spared you?
No, I think he would have cut my heart out, I say. He could walk away from his society, but he would never let it fall. I hear a sound at the door. Apollonius enters, alone. The Ash Lord's eyes darken with hate. But in seeing the state of his nemesis, Apollonius does not look as dismayed as he should.
Ah, I see the Ash Lord has become most literal indeed.
Apollonius sits on the edge of the bed and pulls back the sheets to see the cadaverous legs of the old warlord. He makes a clucking sound with his tongue and prods the flaking skin at the thigh, peeling off a small strip of the scale and grinding it between the metal fingers of his gauntlets till a fine powder sprinkles the bed.
Did the bite hurt?
So it was you, the Ash Lord murmurs. Atlantia did not believe me.
Even from the deep, I have teeth, Apollonius says. I served nobly, without deceit or graft. But you betrayed me to steal from me. You turned my blood against me. That, my goodman, was a dire mistake.
I feel a reptilian fear slipping into me. I back away from Apollonius. Severo points his pulse fist at him.
You knew he was like this, and you did not tell me, I say.
You son of a bitch, Severo hisses.
Apollonius smiles.
The warden did not just buy me tomatoes and whores.
You're dead, shithead.
But Severo doesn't fire.
I did not know it worked, Apollonius says innocently. But I am delighted by the results.
The Ashlord tries to spit at him, but the feeble saliva catches on his own chin.
Is revenge worth sounding the death knell of your race, spoiled cur?
My race?
Apollonius stands.
No, no, my lord. I am a race unto myself.
How long ago? I ask, grabbing Apollonius by the throat. How long ago did you do this?
3 years, he says, not liking my hands on him. Are we not allies any longer?
He steps back measuredly, touching his throat. At the news, Severo looks light-headed.
3 years. 3 years like this. He can't have led his men or fleets on Mercury from here. The time delay would make battle command impossible. But how then did they resist me for so long? Who commanded them? Who is responsible for their new tactics? Who was really behind the hollows of him on his bridge when he spoke those half dozen times?
Yes,
the Ash Lord rasps, as if he can hear my thoughts.
Do you feel the dread yet, slave? Knowing you came all this way, fractured your republic, your family, made a pact with this devil to kill a sick old man at the end of his days.
I fight the urge to scream. I feel like I'm falling. What a waste. What an unbelievable waste.
Who was it? I ask.
The Ash Lord looks at Apollonius.
Who else? The only daughter you have left me.
Atlantia, I whisper.
My last fury.
He smiles with pride.
You destroyed her home. You murdered her sisters. Now you come to take her father. She was a frivolous girl. She would have lived in peace, Darrow. But you have brought her nothing but war.
He mocks me.
All of this for nothing,
Severo murmurs to himself.
We killed Wolfgar for nothing. We came all this way. Darrow.
I don't know what to say.
Where is Atlantia now?
Apollonius asks.
Far from here, the Ash Lord says. The peace talks were her idea. She expected you to dissolve the Senate, take the reins, but you left. You should have gone to your fleet, Darrow.
There were too few ships in orbit. I assumed most were on the far side of the planet. But now I know what he means. Impossible, I say. They would have been detected.
He smiles.
10 years ago, you came upon Luna from the fog of war. She will fall upon your fleet over Mercury. It is at half strength because of your tantrum in your Senate. It will burn, and your fabled army on the surface will burn.
Something inside me knows that he is right, because it would be too fine a world for this to end with him today. If Atlantia has led his forces, if they are en route to destroy the Republic forces, then the war is not ending. It is beginning again. Around and around it goes. I do not know if the Republic can last another blow. It is my fault. I never should have launched the Iron Rain. But for hubris, for so many reasons, I let the rain fall, and it has not stopped since. I shattered my family, killed Wolfgar, came here all for nothing. The Ash Lord watches me realize this with little satisfaction. There is no joy in his final moments, no cruel relish, just a great exhaustion. Orion and Virginia have to know that Atlantia is coming, I say numbly. We have to go.
Do you think I would tell you this if you could hope to influence it?
Darrow, we have to let them know, Severo says.
You came all the way here, the Ash Lord continues, across the great ink, thinking you could kill me and return home to your family. But now there is nothing to return to. No Republic. No family.
No family, I echo. Severo takes a step forward. Say that again?
You left your children behind, didn't you?
Severo lurches forward and grabs him by the neck. What the hell are you talking about? The Ash Lord smiles at him, their faces inches apart.
You are like me. In the end, I spent my children for my war, and now so have you.
Severo's grip goes slack.
Your daughter, he looks at me, and your son, they have been taken.
No. My fingers curl around the wood post of this rotted man's bed, and I feel the shifting of something inside me, the whisper of formless dread that attends when I wake from a horrible nightmare and for a moment forget my human delusions and see the world for as cold a place as it really is.
Dark, hollow wind channels through my heart, and I know I have lost. I left my boy behind.
You're lying, Severo whispers. We're each in our little worlds of dread, each sinking into the darkness, each unable to grasp, to believe that he is telling the truth. This is the spite of a dying man. That is all it can be. That is all I can accept. You're lying, Severo says again. His face is milk pale. But he's not. There is too much satisfaction in him.
Was it you? I whisper. If only. It was one of yours.
Who?
The Ash Lord watches me, and then turns his large head to look away from me, out to the bright sea, where his spirit has already fled.
Lon was right. He says in a rough whisper. The bill comes at the end.
Who took my son? I shout. Who? With an animal scream, Severo launches himself past me and slams his fist into the Ash Lord's face. Again and again, till blood coats Severo's hands to his wrists and the Ash Lord's lips are mangled. I pull at Severo. He hits me right in the jaw. I hold on, sagging against him as he hyperventilates. He shoves me off, wheeling back to the Ash Lord with his razor drawn. We need him alive, I shout. We need to know more. There's a soft pop, and I look back to the Ash Lord to see foam bubbling from his mouth. He spits a false tooth onto the sheets. Apollonius picks it up and brings it to his nose. Poison.
Who stole my child? I say, gripping him.
Tell me.
He smiles, baring his rotting gums.
He won't talk, Apollonia says.
Severo grunts. Doesn't mean he gets to go easy.
I agree with the half-breed,
Apollonia says. He grabs something from atop one of the medical machines, a bottle of antibacterial spray the nurses must have used on the equipment. He takes one of the candles from beside the bed.
No.
The Ash Lord's eyes are wide with fear, his words slurred from the poison.
Apollonius.
I move toward him. Severo shoves me back.
Burn the bastard, he sneers.
But Apollonius looks to me. Reaper. The sorrow in me is fathomless. I killed Wolfgar. I broke my family. I lost my son. For this rotted slaver. Burn him.
No!
The Ash Lord tries to rise from his bed.
Stop!
Ashes to ashes.
Apollonius turns the canister so it points at the Ash Lord.
Dust to dust.
He depresses the canister's release button. Antibacterial residue hisses out onto the Ash Lord, coating him in chemical sheen. Then Apollonius tosses the candle onto the bed. Blue fire explodes as the candle flame catches the alcohol. The Ash Lord screams. Fire races over the dry husk of his skin. He flails against the inferno like a thrashing mantis, his skin contracting and boiling and swelling and blackening as the air of the room fills with acrid smoke. The plastic tubes connected to his gut and arm snap taut and jerk the medical machines toward the bed. Apollonius stands back from the horror in delighted satisfaction. The inferno dances in his eyes and casts maniacal shadows over his high cheekbones. Beside Severo, I feel no satisfaction, only a gaping loneliness. All the friends and families tattered and torn by my war, my choices. Anguish soars at me inside with crueler teeth than these flames. And as the Ash Lord breathes his last, I turn from the murder, as lost as I was when I walked the scaffold 17 years ago and felt the rope around my neck. All I wanted to be then was a father. And now my son is lost.
Chapter 61. Lysander, the Moon Lord. The idle chatter that fills the Hall of Justice in the Ionian Gold's capital city of Sungrave evaporates when Romulus Al'Rah enters the room. He comes in dignified silence, clad in a grey kimono of rough-spun wool. Flanking him are his loyal kin, misshapen Marius, ancient Pandora, a host of die-hard praetors and white-haired veterans. What is missing and notably absent is the younger generation, those of my age or thereabouts. The brilliant students of the post-rising generation all cluster worshipfully around Seraphina, her dustwalkers, and several other notable captains of Ganymede, Callisto, Europa, and a contingent from Saturn's and Uranus's moons up in the stone stadium seats. The Hall of Justice itself is a dark treasure. All its surfaces are faced in a shiny black stone. The nave is triangular, the south, north, and west aisles steeped stadium rows. The towering ceiling narrows until it makes a pyramid, the peak of which is iron. In the winnowing east chancel, 12 Olympic knights sit cross-legged in a bowed line on an elevated white marble podium, looking out at the nave. Each wears a long cape in harmony with their title. Diomedes's is storm grey. Helios's is brilliant white. Behind them, a marble, gold-tipped pyramid floats. The old justice sits to the right of the pyramid in her living chair of elm. The young chance from the duel sits to the left in her chair of bone. One remembers, one promises. After a welcoming benediction and customary rites, Romulus and his men take their seats in the centre of the nave on thin cushions. He has been set apart at the peak of the 40 others. Helios Aulux, Arab Knight of the Olympics, stares out from the shadow of his cape like an imperious falcon, long-necked, bald but for a long white moustache, the ends of which are held together by two iron clasps. Diomedes sits at his right hand. A toadish woman with huge eyes sits to his left, wearing the badge of the Rage Knight. Romulus, Helios begins, his voice a hammer and lacking the nuance for duplicity. Sovereign of the Rim Dominion, Dominatus of House Ra, you have been brought before the Olympic Council for an impartial hearing on charges brought against you by your accuser, Dido Aura. Alone, Dido sits beneath the council, cloaked all in black. To accuse before the council is a perilous endeavour. If Dido's charges are deemed false, she will suffer the fate that would have befallen the man were he convicted. Draconic. Accuser, present your charges. Dido stands without flourish. First, gross negligence during wartime. The Olympics wait for her to continue the list, but she sits down. Whispers are exchanged in the crowd. She brings no charge of treason, just as she said she would not. She played everyone like a sitter. Once her husband is forced to step down or accept co-rule, she will solidify her position. I overhear the two men next to me voicing a different opinion. Base cowardice on her not bringing treason charges, one says. Nepotism there, he knew, he had to know. The room quiets as Helios confirms. You seek no charge of treason? I do not, she says, nothing more, and watches her husband evenly. Very well. The accuser may present her evidence or witnesses for the charge of gross negligence during wartime. This first evidence you may have heard by now. She throws the hollow up into the air and plays Seraphina's evidence of the Reaper's deception to predictable silent response. Romulus sits implacable on the ground, watching the docks die in the air above him and bathe him in the brilliant light. The next item of evidence is Romulus's own communication with Darrow, taken from the sealed communications records of the Battle of Ilium. Romulus's helmet cam feed appears in the air. He's in a hallway filled with smoke. Dying men writhe on the ground around him as he stands, armor spattered in blood, surrounded by mechanized golds and obsidians in the middle of a firefight. His two sons, Diomedes and Aeneas, provide cover for him as he makes a desperate call to Darrow. His face is frantic with fear. Darrow, listen carefully. The Colossus has altered trajectory and is headed for Ganymede. He's going for the docks. Can any ships intercept? The Reaper asks. No, they're out of position. If Octavia can't win, she'll ruin us. Those docks are my people's future. You must take that bridge at all costs. I'll do my best, are the last words of the Reaper. Thank you, Darrow, and good luck. First cohort on me. The connection to Darrow cuts out and we see from Romulus's head cam as he and his sons charge down the hallway. A blinding flash of light goes off. The hull to the right ruptures open, and Aeneas, Romulus's eldest, is speared through the side of his head by a fragment of metal and then sucked out to space. The clip ends. On the floor, Romulus sits in solemn silence. One final clip is loaded. It is a conversation between Romulus and Darrow after the Battle of Ilium concluded. Romulus was in the Hanging Palace of Ganymede. Darrow was on his ship. Their two faces float in the air. As promised, you have independence, Darrow says. Romulus sits on the floor, his face haggard, the stump of his right arm wound with white bandages. And you have your ships, he says very quietly, the spirit stripped from him. But they will not be enough to defeat the Corps. The Ash Lord will be waiting for you. I hope so. I have plans for his master. Romulus pauses. Do you sail on Mars? Perhaps. The Red's eyes mock, his tone insinuates, while Romulus maintains an even air of military civility. The man had just lost a son, an arm, to say nothing of the destroyed docks. What a picture of a gold. There's one thing I found curious about the battle, he says icily. Of all the ships my men boarded, not one nuclear weapon over 5 megatons was found, despite your claims, despite your evidence. My men found plenty enough. Come aboard if you doubt me. It's hardly curious that they would store them on the Colossus. Rock would want to keep them under tight watch. We're only lucky that I managed to take... There's static interference. Bridge when I did. Docks can be rebuilt, lives cannot. It sounds like a threat. Did they ever have them? Would I risk the future of my people on a lie? The slave king smiles cruelly. Your moons are safe. You define your own future now, Romulus. His eyes narrow to 2 thin slits. Do not look the gift horse in the mouth. Indeed. Romulus's silence is heavy as he swallows his anger, his pride, and lets the slave king mock him. I would like your fleet to depart before the end of day. It will take 3 days to search the debris for our survivors. He insults Romulus's request. We will leave then. Very well, my ships will escort your fleet to the boundaries agreed upon. When your flagship crosses into the asteroid belt, you may never return. If one ship under your command crosses the boundary, it will be war between us. I remember the terms. See that you do. Give my regards to the Corps. I'll certainly give yours to the sons of Ares you leave behind. The connection with the Reaper cuts off, but the image of Romulus floats in the air. He shudders, the calm wilting away and giving a glimpse of the broken man beneath. The image sputters out. Dido looks at her husband, sharing the pain of Aeneas's death all over again. Noting the duplicity of the Slave King's actions, it stands as plain fact that more investigation was warranted, not only into the veracity of the nuclear threat, which was supposedly levied against us by the Sovereign, but toward the veracity of the Slave King's actions throughout and preceding the Battle of Ilium. The inquiry which was commissioned by the Council was quickly scuttled by my husband. I do not believe there is evidence he knew the dark truth of the Slave King's actions against our docks. She says this to temper the fury of the Ganymede Golds, who built the docks and saw them fall on their cities. But I am not beyond bounds by saying more effort should have gone into assessing the truth. Now I would like to call Seraphina Alra to the floor. Seraphina defends and stands between Dido and Romulus. Dido addresses her daughter. When you acquired the hologram evidence of the destruction of the docks and returned with it into Rim space, were you arrested by sworn men of the Sovereign? I was, as I should have been. Did you divulge to them the nature of the information you carried? I did not. Did at any point Romulus admit to knowing the truth about the destruction of the docks? He did not. Seraphina looks at her father. His actions toward me and the secrecy under which they were enacted were done to protect me from capital punishment for breaking the Pax Solaris. It was a father's love, not a man's schemes. He knew I entered the Gulf. I did not know if he was aware of the reasons why, but he knew he would have to bring me before the Moon Council. Do you believe he committed negligence during wartime? It is not my duty to judge. Thank you, Ariette. Seraphina salutes with her fist to her heart and returns to her place amongst her friends. Dido closes her argument. My charges are limited because, while I believe my husband misstepped by not investigating further, I do not believe there is evidence to prove he was complicit in hiding information from the Council. I do not believe anyone here could call him a traitor. One of the Ganymedes shouts their dissent. Thus I ask only for impeachment from his position as Sovereign. She sits down. Helios continues. Romulus, do you contest these charges? Romulus stands. I do not. You wish to offer no mitigating evidence? I do not. In the charge of negligence, I am guilty. Heads nod in approval. This is an honourable response, one they expected, one that an Iron Gold would give. On Luna, this trial would have stretched out over the course of years with endless appeals and warehouses of evidence and armies of copper lawyers. By the time it was through, half those involved would be dead or have had their relatives kidnapped and tortured till they came to the correct judgment. My grandmother would have burned the government to the ground before releasing her clutch on power. She could have learned a thing or two from this man. On the dais, Diomedes looks like a man freed from the gallows. His father will be stripped of the sovereignty for negligence, but any prison time will be commuted on the grounds of the pending war. Romulus will likely even lead his family's forces under Dido's command. It's a marvel. But then in the chancel, behind the Olympic Knights, a fragile chime shatters all well-laid plans. The council turns to look back at the sound. Chance, hardly 10 years of age, stands barefoot and quiet in front of her chair, holding a small iron bell. Her white eyes stare out at the terrifying host. Dido frowns, confused. Seraphina whispers to her friends, I feel the rush of impending doom. The memory howls with warning because I remember my tutor, Hieronymus, droning on about ancient codices outlining the rules of an impeachment trial. Most forget that the Whites are not set behind the Olympics for show. They cannot decide a verdict, but they do have one unique, archaic power. It is where the phrase, unless chance strikes, originates. Helios beckons the small girl forward. She comes to whisper in his ear. His face tightens. She returns to her seat, and the knights discuss amongst themselves. Whatever is said turns Diomedes sheet white. I glance up at Seraphina and can sense her distress even from across the room. Diomedes is shaking his head at Helios, as are two of the younger knights. The Death Knight, an older woman, walks from the end of the dais to confer with Helios and vehemently stabs her finger in the air. The younger knights don't like what she said, but after Helios seems to agree, their objections fade and they slowly nod their heads in compliance. Helios calls order to the room. We have discussed amongst ourselves and have come to an agreement. While it is seldom invoked, the Fates are afforded the right to levy additional charges against the accused on behalf of the state. It brings us no pleasure to voice these charges, but we, the Olympic Council, are bound by duty to charge Romulus Arra with one count of arch treason. The room upturns. Peerless, bound to their feet, Dido raves on the floor. I do not seek that charge.
It does not matter, Helios says.
This is my trial, my charges. It is the purview of the Fates to request to add charges. You know this, now sit down.
Diomedes. The council has spoken, mother, Diomedes says. He looks like he's going to pass out. You must desist.
Enraged, Dido sits, casting a horrified look at her husband. The punishment for treason is death.
While his men behind him are in a holy rage, Romulus alone seems unaffected and waits patiently for Helios to continue.
While the Fates may demand additional charges, it is not in their power to present evidence. Thus it should be a simple matter, and one that should be stated for the records so that there are no lingering resentments that might eat at the foundation of our dominion as we enter our most dire hour. Our chance was wise and correct to invoke her right. Let us clear the air and move forward as one people. He looks at Romulus with a sigh. My friend, it annoys me to insult you, but I am bound by my office.
Of course.
Two simple questions, two simple answers, and we move forward.
Did you know that Darrow of Lycos destroyed the docks, and did you conspire to conceal this from us, yes or no?
Romulus wears a tranquil expression, the same I saw on his face as he dissected his razor when we first met. He stands slowly and steps off his small cushion and lets his lone arm fall down his side to tug on the cape so that it is smooth behind him. He lifts his head to the council, then to his wife, with eyes that seem to gaze far beyond the people in this room.
Romulus, his wife whispers, knowing the spirit of him. Don't.
Yes, says the Moon Lord. I knew, and I did so conspire. The silence of the room shatters a second time, an uproar from the stands, from Dido, from all but Romulus's men and the council itself. Diomedes sits stunned. Seraphina looks around like a lost little girl.
He does not mean it, Dido hisses to the council. He does not mean it. Strike it from the record and convene a new trial for that charge.
Helios is just as astounded.
I cannot.
He's perjuring himself, Dido says. It is a lie. He had no evidence. Supposition doesn't count. We all saw the recording. It can be inferred but not proven. All we have evidence of is his negligence. Diomedes, tell him.
Mother, Diomedes says helplessly, by his own admission.
Damn his admission, boy. He's your father. He's Romulus our gory damned Ra.
My heart breaks watching her spin helplessly about, as if she were a drowning woman the rest of us could not help. I am as lost myself.
Dido, Romulus says from behind her, please.
She turns to him, still in denial, but slowly as she looks into his eyes, she knows that there is no going back, and all at once a shiver goes through her that I can see from 40 meters back, as her reality, her family, are irrevocably shattered, and she knows it is her doing.
Tell them you're lying, she whispers. Tell them you had suspicions but didn't know.
But I knew, Romulus says. I knew because the holodrop you sent Seraphina to collect was offered to me first.
What?
He looks up at the council as if he's already parted from the world.
It was offered to me. Several images were sent. I invited the brokers to the rim, where they met around Enceladus. I relied upon my reputation of honor to lure them and the original copy there. I took out a warhawk and killed them all and burned their ship. Of course, as you have seen, there was a copy.
You did this by yourself? Helios asks, looking at Pandora.
I am Romulus Al-Ra, he smiles sadly. You might ask yourself why I did this. Why I tell you this now when it will cost me my own life? All my days I have lived as honorably as a man can, but I have carried this secret for too long. And, as my father would ask, what is honor without truth? Honor is not what you say. Honor is what you do.
A cold stone settles in my throat as I watch Seraphina's heart break. Tears leak down her cheeks.
We live by a code. I broke that code, even if my reasons for doing so were just. Let it serve as a warning to you all. I lied because I knew if we saw what the slave king did to the docks, we would have no choice but to declare the peace void and sail for war. I believe that war will destroy us, all of us, Rim and Core alike. All that the colors have built together, all we have protected, the legacy of the society will vanish. Not because our arms are weak, not because our commanders are frail,
but because we are fighting against a religion whose god still lives. At this moment he is mortal, he strains under the burden of rule and the seams of their alliances fray, but if we sail on Mars or Luna, the colours will unite. They will become a tide, and their now mortal general will become once again their god of war. And if he falls, another will rise, and another, and another. We are too few. We are too honourable. We will lose this war just as surely as I will now lose my life. I urge you to feel my death, to let it be the last casualty and not the first of this war that claimed my father, my daughter, my son, and now me. Seraphina bursts into tears. Dido hangs her head, her body limp. I feel the stirring of my own grief, a reflection of the grief I felt for Cassius's death. It is tragic to see a man's nature doom him, especially when it is a nature so fine as Romulus's. Helios stands, his voice barely even a whisper. Romulus Aura, you are found guilty of the charges levied against you. Guards, seize the convicted and prepare him to return to the dust. Chapter 62. Lysander, Iron Gold. Amongst a host of moon lords on a frozen sulphur dune, Romulus says farewell to his children. Only Ra are in attendance. I do not know why I have been invited. Wearing a krill and a scora suit, I watch from the end of their ranks as he bends to press his forehead against young Panoran's. The child weeps for his father. The tears freeze on his cheeks. Romulus stands before Marius. The two men press their foreheads together stoically. Forgive your mother, honour me and serve the rim, Romulus says. As you wish, father. Marius watches icily as his father moves on to Diomedes. The warrior looks down at his father like a giant child hoping beyond all hope for the man to perform some miracle and make this all a dream. I'm sorry, father, he says, a huge sob stuck in his chest. His father lays a firm hand on his shoulder. I have failed you. No, I should never have involved you in this. But what luck I have to call a man like you my son. It is an honour you cannot understand. One day you will have children, and if you have just one who is as dear as you are to me, you will understand how blessed my life has been. Stay true to your own heart, no matter the cost. They say farewell, and Romulus goes to Seraphina. Guilt and grief rack her. He puts his forehead to hers. My burning one. She recoils from him. You don't have to die. If I live, I divide the rim. You might forgive, but how could the Codovans? How could anyone on Ganymede, who lost a son, a daughter? They've been denied justice because of my lie. I hope this cools their blood, but if the rim does go to war, it must go as one. Seraphina says nothing. He touches her face. The same spirit is in you that was in my brother. Do not let it consume you like it did him. You have nothing to prove. Glory for others is nothing. He touches her heart. What matters is in here. Honor your conscience, honor your family. His eyes crinkle as he smiles behind the krill. One day you will understand why I've done this. I will never understand. He tries to embrace her, but she pulls back from him and walks away from the family across the dune as Diomedes calls to her. Romulus watches her go. He does not move on to Dido or his mother, who chose not to come watch her son die, but instead he walks to me. Lord Ra, I say, lowering my head. There are some who would say I should bow to you, heir of Selenius, he says. Most who'd say that are dead, I reply. Besides, I'm a guest in your home. Very true. He motions for me to follow him, and we walk a few paces away from his family. The cold wind howls around us, flinging debris into the reflective goggles I wear. The krill warms the air as it passes through the membrane into my mouth. Romulus looks back to his family. They wonder why I've brought you here. They're not the only ones. He examines me with his lone eye. You look very much like your mother. You knew her? Not well. He sees me look at Seraphina, who sits on the edge of a distant dune watching us. Why did you ask me to come here, my lord? There is still a chance to stop this war, Lysander. Maybe not to stop it from beginning. I fear the blood has risen too high for that. Even my death will not stop it. But there is a chance to stop it from destroying us all. Our strength before the rising did not come from our arms or our ships. It came from our unity. Long ago, Selenius our loon, your blood, and Akari our Ra, my blood, stood together. One the scepter, one the sword. They gave birth to the Pax Solaris. They freed us from Earth's dominion. You face a choice that will touch lives far beyond your sight. Run as you have these last years, or become the echo of those great men. He leans forward, his voice husky and full of emotion. That lone eye seemed suspended in his face, celestial and untethered from its mortal body. He sets his hand on my shoulder. You saved my daughter. Can you now save the world's? He does not wait for a response, which I am far too stunned to give. He walks back to his family to say farewell to his wife. I am left overcome with the weight of his question. I already took the first step in ignoring Cassius's dying wish. The second with the betrayal of Gaia. Do I have the strength to take the rest? Can I bear the burden of my blood? I watch Romulus say his final farewells. The great man looks at Dido with so much love I know I can't fathom it. I have never known love like theirs. Seraphina sits alone on the dune, and I wonder how Romulus felt when he first saw Dido all those years ago on Venus. If he loved her so much, how could he be so brave as to choose to say farewell? Is it really true, pure honour? After having been ripped from my family, I'm at a loss, unable to understand how a man, a father, a husband, could value something more than love. It awakens something deep inside me, a desire to be as noble as he is now, a need to honour his memory, though I barely knew the man. These 10 years I've been looking for the man I married, Dido says to her husband. I strain to hear them over the wind. Now I see him again, the young moon lord who burned a city for a girl of the Pearl Shore. Romulus the Bold, Dido of Numidi. What a pair they were, what an end they had. No, he whispers, this is not the end. I loved you before I ever met you. I will love you until the sun dies, and when it does, I will love you in the darkness. Goodbye, wife. Stepping close, he removes his krill and, holding his breath against the toxic air, gently unfastens Dido's to pull her into one last kiss. Steam billows from their lips as they cling at one another. Then Romulus pulls away and tosses his krill on the ground to step backward down the dune. Seraphina watches from her perch on the dune. It does not seem right for her to be alone now. I find myself walking toward her up the frozen sulphur. She says nothing as I sit beside her to watch her father's last rite. Under the watchful gaze of two obsidian adjuncts to the White Justice, Romulus removes his boots, his cloak, his scorer suit beneath, his liner and his undergarments, till he is naked and pale there on the frozen sulphur. Across the waste, he must walk for 80 steps to reach the resting place of Akaria Rao, the founder of his house. The dragon tomb is a giant black obelisk shaped like a winged beast at the top of a stubby crag of rock. Hunched, frozen bodies litter the dune around the tomb and cling to the rock formation itself. Ra, who in old age or punishment or shame came here to die, and in death seek to reach their ancestor, and erect a humble monument to their own strength. Only 4 have ever made it to the dragon tomb. Romulus seeks to join the honourable dead. It is below -100°C. Convulsing from the cold, he turns to face us, hiding nothing. His chest is scarred and pale, his stomach flat and muscled, his ribs stand out. His remaining arm is corded with stringy fibres, and as the wind ripples across the waste, his extremities begin to purple from the cold. His hair, unbound behind his head, whips till the moisture in it freezes. He roars, "I am a son of Io, a child of the dust." Steam clouds his words as he spends his last breath. His fist thumps his chest with each proclamation, leaving a shadow of pink over the paling skin. "I'm a dragon of Ra, an iron gold, a Kari bear witness," he whispers something to himself. Then he turns and walks down the dune toward death, his hand at his side, his shoulders proud and square, head held back in defiance of the cold and poisoned air. The frozen sulfur crystals crack under his feet, wounding the skin. By the 10th step, blood smears a glittering red trail behind him. By the 20th, his body shudders against the wind. 29, Seraphina whispers, counting her father's steps. Romulus clutches his chest with his one arm, desperate to keep his spirit of warmth from the gnawing moon. 32. His spine stands out as he hunches. 37. His hair is frozen and no longer whips in the wind, but clumps to the back of his neck like a dead animal. 45. He drifts sideways, his path bending away from the monument. 50. He falls to his knees. Paran sobs at his mother's side. Dido watches without blinking. Frost crusts her eyelashes. Romulus wills himself up. Blood pours down his knees and freezes to his shins as he stumbles on, his will inexorable. 1 foot after the other, they are black and red now, blood frozen onto the bottom of the dead flesh to make a shoe. 60. Seraphina's voice grows louder, wishing her father a triumph in the end. 64. The man will not stop. His will is immense. All the pain of all the years has culminated into this single testament of will to prove to the moon that despite its horrors, it is under his power. 68. I find myself wishing strength. 70. Romulus takes another impossible step up the side of the dune. Then his legs betray him. He falls hard to the ground 10 steps from the monument, striking his head on the ice before sliding back, supine. His black hand paws at the ground, steam seeps from his mouth, but with one arm he cannot lift himself up. He heaves himself upward one last time. The effort is in vain. He does not stand again. Soon he does not move. Ice crusts over his white body amongst the corpses of his humbled ancestors. 10 steps from the honored golds who reach the monument lies the greatest man of a people. Pulvis et umbra sumus. Seraphina whispers, and I alone hear her. Below, the family weeps, the moon howls, the darkness quickens, and the Ra leave their father behind and, like the dust, fly away with the wind and fade into the ebbing twilight. Chapter 63. Lysander. Lux ex tenebris. Dido sits slumped in a low chair by a window that looks out over the sulphur plain. The weather is clear. Her arms hang off the edge of the armrests. Her large, angry eyes look out into the waste but are trained on her past. She is an island of regret, bled of pride, of spirit, and swollen with the torpor of loss. "What is it you want, Loon?" she asks, this without turning around when Seraphina and I enter the room. The young woman escorted me in silence. "I'm sorry for your loss," I say. She does not respond. I glance nervously at Seraphina, knowing my presence here is unwanted in this moment of grief. The girl looks back at me with cold, inhospitable eyes. "He was the noblest of men." "What do you know of my husband?" she asks harshly. "From what he said to me before he died, I learned enough. He was something out of time, a paragon, his life spent honouring the conquerors, but he was greater by far than they could ever have been. Now, such a waste." She shakes her head. "Uncurl your tongue, boy, and leave me to my grief." "I wish to join your war," I say flatly. She watches a lone volcano vomit ash into the chrome horizon. Seraphina scowls. "There's no place for a loon in our army." "I beg to differ." "And what good would you do me, Lysander, our loon?" Dido asks. "Can you skim a dune like a dusk walker, or fly a warhawk in a storm, or operate a star shell in an iron rain as your friends die around you?" she snorts. "You have no scar. You know theory, games. You were raised in a palace, raised to be a king, and there is no more wretched a creature than a king without a kingdom." "I am not a king." "Then what are you?" "What am I? I have been asking this of myself for a decade or more. Little has been certain since my grandmother fell. I looked out at the worlds in flux, in constant motion beneath my feet, denying me a foundation, filling me with uncertainty, fear. I did not know my own heart, but no matter the shifting of the worlds, I know the bedrock of my soul. I know the foundation upon which I stand and no longer fear my blood. Just because my grandmother was a tyrant does not mean I will be. I see the faces of those I left behind on the Vindobona. They need a protector, a shepherd. I know who I am, or at least who I want to become. And with that realization, I feel the culmination of the souls who have filled my life. I feel my father's calm, Arja's love, my grandmother's brilliance, Cassius's honor, and even the faint heartbeat of my mother. And I know that Romulus spoke wisdom I somehow already knew deep in the heart of me. "I am no heir of empire or conqueror of men," I say slowly, "but I have the same birthright as you, the same inheritance. We were created because Earth broke itself, because man disintegrated into tribal strife. Chaos is the nature of man, order the dream of gold. We were made to shepherd, to unite despite our differences. That is what Romulus said to me in the end, and he is right." Seraphina stares at me, a rebuke frozen on her lips. "You called my grandmother a tyrant. She was, but I am not her. I am not Arja. I am not my godfather. I am an iron gold." Slowly, Dido turns around. "As you gather your armada to sail on the rising, send me to the core with a cohort of your best. I will find my godfather. I will tell him that the rim is coming, that the sins of the past must be forgotten, and that you seek an alliance against the Reaper so that gold may be united once again. If peace must be brought with a sword, let us hold it together." The silence stretches between us. She stands imperiously over me. Then her eyes narrow, and slowly on Dido's dour, grieving face, her lips curl into a smile.
Chapter 64. Ephraim, Locust Queen. I slump over the controls, guiding us over the grey cityscape at high altitude. Electra sits in the co-pilot chair with the razor pointed at me from the side. Of course, the little warlords know first aid. Pax has cut open my shirt and sealed the hole in my chest with res flesh from the ship's medkit, but I'm in shit shape. Need a doctor and blood packs, or I'll die, and soon. I'd rather bleed out in this ship than die in a cell, but that's not much of a choice anymore. I eye my Omni in Electra's lap and wonder if I could throw the ship hard to port and get a jump on the little bastards. How far are we? Pax says. Republic escorts are 20 out. I eye the roofs beneath us and the flow of pedestrian traffic in the airspace below and wonder if the Syndicate can still reach us here. You're going to make it? Electra asks me. Do I look like a yellow? Can you feel your hands? She asks. No. She looks back at Pax. Don't look at him, hatchet face. I'd rather fly unconscious than let a kid behind the grip of a... I grimace at the pain. Of a hornet. I fly grav bikes all the time, the boy says. This ain't a grav bike, kid. A cold sweat soaks my body. I wipe my face and wish that Vulgar were here now. I feel naked without her, just as I did the entire time I was with the Duke. What's that light? Electra says, pointing to the communicator. Incoming message, Pax says. Could be Mother. He opens the channel, and a noseless face, distorted by a facial scrambler, appears over the holopad between the pilot and co-pilot seats. The pixels swirl together, looking like a plague of marauding locusts forming a head with gaps for the mouth and eyes and the twirling black tips of a ghost crown. Ephraim T. Horn. The disembodied head of the Syndicate Queen rasps over the ship's speakers. Whatever blood is left in me chills. The children are struck dumb, smart enough to know when to be afraid. Let me guess, you'd be the queen bitch, eh? I say thinly. You will return the children. Of course I will. In exchange, I'll take a private island on Venus with a legion of pinks to bring me cocktails and little coconut shells. Not a bad life, eh? I laugh at the locust face. Let me guess. You're going to offer me 3 islands. Well, fuck that and fuck you. I'm not afraid of dying and certainly not afraid of you. Ephraim out. I reach and shut off the communicator, but the hologram doesn't obey. The empty eyes stare at me from the mutinous pixels. I gave this ship to the Duke, the shadowy face rasps. I own it. I own you. Soon I will see you in the flesh. While you still have it. Till then, thief. The ship suddenly banks hard to port, throwing Pax sideways behind me. He slams against a bulkhead. My body jerks against the pilot restraints. What's happening? Pax asks, picking himself up. His forehead is bleeding. The ship's turning around, I whisper. Back to the Syndicate, Pax says. Well, turn it back, Electra shouts. Good idea, I'll just do that, I snap. The steering has gone dead. The secondary electrical controls are off. It's being flown remotely. Comms are dead. My mouth's gone dry. I look frantically for some sort of override, but the control isn't physical. It's coded into the ship's computer. The escorts won't reach us in time, I say. They'll land us at some Syndicate facility, and that will be the last the world ever knows of us. But it won't end there. No, they'll draw it out for years. And what will happen to Vulgar then? Slag this. I totter to my feet, almost falling down. Pax catches me. I sway there, trying to slow down the spinning. Thanks. What are you going to do? Electra asks. Something stupid.
She reaches for her restraints. Stay, hatchet face. I grip Pax by his collar and shove him to the chair. Both of you, strap in. I leave them, exchanging confused glances as they strap themselves into the pilot and co-pilot chairs. I stumble back through the ship, using the wall to support me. Where are you? I shove open doors and lockers, finding fridges of champagne and caviar and dining sets. Come on! Blackness is creeping into the fringes of my vision. I fall down, catching myself on the cushion of an inset dining area. I fumble with the Zoladone dispenser in my pocket. I drop it on the floor and pick it up. I pop 3 Zoladone between my molars. An electric thrill vibrates through my veins, numbing the pain in my chest. I struggle to my feet, and in the back of the ship, near the disembarkation ramp, I find what I was looking for, a walnut-paneled locker full of weapons. Beneath a row of pulse rifles and elegant railguns rests a stack of thermal grenades in formafoam. Someone is laughing. It's me. I pull the grenades out, clutch them to my chest, and shimmy to the back of the ship toward the engines. I cluster the grenades on the ground near a cooling unit and shudder out of breath. Here goes something. I set the timer on one of the grenades to 30 seconds and, with a laugh, drop it amongst the pile. I race back the way I came. Well, I try to race with rubber legs, pulling myself back toward the front of the ship, using my arms to hold myself up, counting silently to myself. I reach the front cockpit, seal the door behind me, and collapse into a passenger chair along the wall behind the pilots. Pax and Electra stare at me as I buckle tight the safety restraints. Jove on high, let there be crash webbing in this seat. What did you do? Pax asks. Told you, something stupid. 4, 3, assume the position. Their eyes widen and they cover their heads with their hands. A deafening roar comes from the back of the ship. The door to the cockpit buckles inward. The ship pitches sideways and begins to spiral down as the gravity thrusters fail in stuttering gasps. Then they give out and we're plummeting down, the city and sky whipping past outside the cockpit windows. As we careen down into the wasted skeleton city landscape of one of the Jackal's craters, I can't help but laugh bitterly. I knew this was gonna be a one-way ticket.